Thanks for taking the time to download our show, Manage Your Money God's Way. We are from Compass Catholic Ministries, teaching what the Bible tells us are the best ways to handle money. And we share these biblical principles in our six-week Bible study called Faith and Money Matters. Learn more by going to compasscatholic.org. Well, this particular show aired about a month ago, and the response has been overwhelming to the point that we thought it was valuable to air it again. So this is a repeat of the 2020 financial checklist. Well, each year at this time, we like to close the calendar year and kind of get you ready for a brand new year. And we'd like to take you through a financial checklist of items that you need to be aware of as we venture into 2020. So as 2020 approaches, we invited our resident financial advisor, John Kennedy, who is a partner with Candor Path Financial here in Orlando, to join us today and help us go through that 2020 checklist. So, John, let's begin by going through the advice that you would share with your clients and, of course, those listening on what they need to be aware of venturing into 2020. Let's begin with a financial strategy. Do couples and individuals need to change or tweak their financial strategy from year to year?
I think the strategy changes often, and honestly, it's something that we should be looking at numerous times throughout the year. I think going into 2020, a couple of things that I would really recommend as we prepare for a recession, that big scary R word, we don't know when it's coming, when it's going to happen, but we want to be prepared for it. I think focusing on a strategy for paying down your debts, and then potentially not being afraid to be too cash heavy. I think a lot of times people want to stop at their 3 or 6 month marker for how much they have in cash savings for their emergency bucket, but right now is a good time to be cash heavy and be opportunistic with it in the future.
So as you review their plans, how much adjustments take place, or does it depend on your clients think is going to happen over the next 12 months?
Yeah, I think it actually depends more on what stage of life that they're in. So if we're getting closer and closer to retirement, we want to make sure that we're reviewing the portfolio more frequently, that we're not too aggressive, we're not too conservative and that type of thing. But I think it really just depends on where you're at. If you're in my demographic, if you're in your mid-30s, then certainly that's a different strategy and we can afford to be a little more aggressive.
Okay, let's talk about someone who in 2020 says, I'm retiring in the next 6 months, next 12 months. What type of recommendation is given them? What do they have to do different? What kind of checklist should they put together?
I think the big three elements that would be worthy of consideration if they're that close is understanding where you're spending, you know, what your expenses are, and then probably inflating that number by 10%, you know, because we all project what our expenses are going to be or what we think our lifestyle will be in retirement. And then oftentimes when we retire and you have this time on your hands to do the things that you've always wanted to do, you end up spending a little bit more than initially anticipated.
So somebody that uses a retirement calculator, I always notice that the default setting is 70 to 75% of what they're currently spending. That's false.
Well, the reason that they do that is because you factor other components of your overall spending, like your taxes are going to be less and you're not going to be saving to your 401k anymore once you're retired. So part of that is why that percentage is less, but I'm talking about true lifestyle spending, you know, vacations, visiting your family, spending time with your family. Those costs actually tend to go up as we enter retirement.
So don't those offset each other? The decrease in taxes is offset by the increase in fun activities.
I'd say so. Yeah, I'd say so. That's why we always like to inflate those numbers just to be cautious, right? If it works in that scenario, it should work in any scenario.
Well, and the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to have a little bit more money to spend or save or give, right?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
And actually, our experience has been that we're spending pretty much exactly the same now in retirement as we did for the 10 or 15 years before we retired. And we don't have the house payment anymore, and we're not doing the savings like we were before, but it gets eaten up. I think travel is probably the biggest piece of it. That, and we've never been in a house so long that we had to do repairs and remodel and repaint.
And maintenance.
Yeah. That's always a really big expense for people going into retirement. And the other one, honestly, is Medicare. You know, what are the expenses of healthcare over the next 20 or 30 years as you get into retirement? It's something that I think a lot of people overlook.
So let's stay on the theme of retirement.
Sure.
In 2020, I'm going to receive a 4% increase. How does that translate? Should I increase my contribution to my 401k, my IRA? I mean, what's the difference from being status quo, I'll stay at 6%, or upping it to 8, 9, 10%?
I mean, that's incredible. Anytime you get the opportunity to capitalize on saving a few more percentage points on your 401k, it's really powerful. In fact, you know, if you look at it over the course of a, you know, obviously the longer the time horizon, the more impactful it is. But if you went from, let's say, 6% to 9% over a 30-year period, you're looking at over $300,000 additional
really?
In your portfolio. Yeah.
How much?
$300,000.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, we make some assumptions there, but just a static percentage of 7.5% return on your overall portfolio and just inflation, you know, adjust your income by 3.5% every year, you know, as your income goes up. The difference between 6 to 9% is over $300,000.
Wow.
Huge. 3% can equate to that over a 30-year period of time.
John, in 2020, what is the maximum that you can contribute to a 401k or an IRA?
Yeah, so the IRA didn't change. So it's still $6,000 a year.
Okay.
And if you're over the age of 50, you get a $1,000 catch-up. What did change, though, are 401ks and 403bs. So that went from $19,000 this year in 2019 to $19,500.
Okay.
And the catch-up is now $6,500.
But you can only play catch-up if you're over 50.
Over 50, correct.
And that's a one-time, or you can do that over the course of the year?
Each year.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the number changes each year.
That's what I meant. Yeah, the number changes each year. And how you choose to do that's up to you. You could do it as a one-time. You could do it systematically over your paychecks.
John, what would you tell somebody who's maybe they're in a catch-up position, so they're going to dump a bunch of extra money into their 401 or their 403b. The employer's plan is really stock-heavy in the employer's stock.
Sure.
So you're really putting, you know, a ton of money into your employer's stock. It's not greatly diversified. What would you tell somebody in that kind of a situation? Because I know that happens.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think nowadays, most 401k plans default, even if it's to 12 or 15 different options that you can pick from, a lot of them will default to the company stock, but you have the option to re-diversify those. So it might be more of a manual process where you need to go in and periodically look at it. But my answer to that would be just doing an audit of all the options that you have and probably diversifying away from the company stock.
Especially if the match that the company gives you is in their stock.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, John, 70.5 seems to be the magic number. So I turned 70.5 this year, or in 2020. Mandatory distribution. Does that change next year? Is it still going to be 70.5?
Yeah. So 70.5 is that baseline number. And then every year after that, you have to take your required minimum distribution.
And the minimum percentage is?
That changes every year. It's simply based on your age. So there's a formula that the IRS gives you. So it's basically just a math formula based on the account value as of 12/31 of the prior year. And then your RMD factor, which is exclusively based on your age. So if you're 74, that RMD factor is different than if you're 71.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's just like an actuarial table.
Speaking on the subject of retirement, once you get into that retirement zone, whether I'm going to retire in 2020 or 2021, does my strategy change? Do you recommend I become more conservative, or if I've been very aggressive, do I stay in that strategy?
I think potentially, if it suits you. I mean, the big things that I would say is, again, understanding your spending and your expenses, and then doing a risk audit of your portfolio. You really want to know, okay, how, you know, if the markets drop by 20%, I'll just throw a number out there. They drop by 20%. How much is that going to impact my portfolio? And can I sleep at night with that? I mean, that's kind of the gut check question, is understanding how much risk you're taking. If you're comfortable with it and you believe in the markets in the long run, there's nothing wrong with that. But there is this element of matching diversification based on how much risk you're actually comfortable with taking.
So that's almost like our crisis budget. When we talk about budgeting, there's a worst case scenario that says if one of us loses a job, this is what our spending would be. And that's if the market really tanks, then what is our income from our savings?
Absolutely. That's why we start with that spending number, because we want to know, okay, well, how much does the portfolio need to maintain to support the lifestyle that you want in retirement?
Is there a certain percentage you use for that?
Yeah, typically between 3 to 4%. It's not an aggressive number, but we at least can feel confident that with those percentages, despite market fluctuation, we can feel relatively confident that the portfolio will be there over the long term.
If somebody retires before full retirement age, so they don't have Medicare, they don't have a salary, okay, and they have to take money out of their savings plan, how does that work? You know, if they're going to need maybe for 4 or 5 or 6 years, they're going to need 8 to 10% out of their savings plan, which is like double or more of what you just suggested as a reasonable number.
Mm-hmm.
What has to happen down the road in order to keep them solvent 25 years from now?
Yeah, there's probably in that scenario a lot of planning for many years leading up to that point. You know, so you've got enough assets in non-qualified investments as well as qualified, like your 401ks and IRAs. And then you make sure that we have enough in different buckets of these monies. So long-term being more aggressive, short-term being like your cash position. I think we advise, just as you do too, that someone retiring today should have upwards of a year's worth of expenses saved in cash.
Yes.
Just ready to deploy for that scenario. So you're, if you think of it that way, you're a year separated from any kind of market risk that could happen anyway. But that's a tough one to answer, because honestly, it just, that means that that was years of planning ahead of time for that scenario.
Yeah, that's not something you decide on today and do it tomorrow.
Yeah,
you really
yeah,
need to get yourself into position over a long period of time.
Right. I think, you know, the average American who's looking at targeting, let's say, 65 or 66 as retirement, if they're 58 now and they look at this and say, I'm going to retire tomorrow, their ability to do so is probably predicated on the fact that they've been planning for years for that scenario. They don't just wake up and say they can, because financially, a lot of people, unfortunately, can't just do that.
John, explain the advantages of, as you mentioned, in retirement, have a year's expense in cash saved up, the advantages of having it in cash.
Well, I think it insulates you from, it goes back to this whole risk conversation. If the market's fluctuating up and down keeps you up at night, but yet you know you have 1 year's worth of expenses saved, you're just insulated 12 months from actually needing those funds. And so it gives the portfolio a little room to breathe, and ultimately it gives you some peace of mind. So really, to me, the advantage is more of that emotional or psychological perspective of knowing, hey, I don't have to worry about what the markets are doing today because I've got a year's worth of cash flow.
So in our Bible study, Faith and Money Matters, we discuss the importance of saving and investing. So someone just graduating from college and they want to get into saving and investing, but they see the market, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. How do you plan with them, I mean, to make them feel comfortable?
Yeah, I think that's probably done over a series of meetings, just providing perspective that, hey, if you look at the market over a 10 or a 20 period of time or even longer, it's going to go up and it's going to go down. But in the long run, it does go up. So then ultimately, and by the way, that early on in your life, it's really more of the inputs of the hard work that that individual is doing. The portfolio is not going to do the heavy lifting on moving the needle on your net worth yet at that stage of the game. So it's really more about building the discipline and the habits of doing things like saving to the 401k and adding to your HSA and having your emergency bucket.
So if the market goes down, you don't want to stop investing. You want to keep dumping, and maybe even more.
Absolutely.
Because the prices are lower.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really just having that conversation and getting that person comfortable with the fact that, hey, it's going to go up and down, but you're not touching this thing for 30, 40 years, right? You've got time on your side.
So in 2020, I'm going to retire, and I'm also going to turn 62. The big question is, should I take Social Security? Tell me
yep.
why I should or why I should wait.
Well, we talked about this one before, and I think this is the hardest question for me to answer, because mathematically speaking, the true answer would be wait until 70, right? I think roughly the break-even point is somewhere around age 84. And what I mean by that is if you had deferred until age 70, so you gave up, depending on how you're looking at it, anywhere from 4 to 8 years of a Social Security benefit to collect later. each year you wait, it grows at 8%. So your check is higher starting at age 70, right? So if you lived to age 84 and older, that's that break-even age where that made mathematical sense.
Okay.
So I think most people retiring, you know, we have hopes that we're going to live past that age. So mathematically, that's the, you know, it's an easy answer of 70. Well, here's where this is really difficult. What's your family genetics? How long do you feel like you're potentially going to live? Do you have cash flow needs in the current, in the now, that almost necessitate you to pull from it earlier? So it's just not a clear-cut answer, and it's more, for us, it's more conversational-based to figure out the person's situation.
And I think those cash needs that you might have in the present day, depending on how much they are, that's going to deplete, and you've got to take 100% of your income then,
yep,
which depletes it even larger, you know, sure, a larger amount. There's a lot of different moving pieces there that,
yeah. And you know, the other side to this is, I had a client tell me the other day, I haven't had in my family history, no one's lived past age 84. So I mean, when you look at it that
so
way,
why would you do that?
Right for him, it gave him more peace of mind to know, you know what, I can take the cash in hand now and start collecting on my Social Security check now rather than waiting.
So as we look to 2020, what are some of the other things on the checklist that we, as let's say your clients, they should be looking at, or decisions to be made in 2020?
Yeah. So my big checklist, I wanted to keep it simple. So I wanted to give three actionable items.
Okay.
And just to recap, the first is understanding your spending and your expenses in retirement. Doing a risk audit of your portfolio, kind of that gut check to make sure it's not too aggressive. And then last but not least, and I alluded to this before, it's understanding Medicare. A couple retiring this year will spend $285,000 on average over the course of their retirement on healthcare needs.
Really?
And by the way, that's growing. It's you know, the studies are suggesting it's growing at about 5.5% a year. So it's actually certainly outpacing what we're getting on our Social Security check, right? Yeah.
So is that the total that they're paying, or
correct,
the total cost of the healthcare they're getting?
The total cost. I believe that's the total cost of the healthcare that they're getting.
Okay, so that it's doesn't come cost out of their pocket.
Well, it depends, right? It depends, yeah, on what type of healthcare coverage they have in retirement.
Okay.
And so if you do the math, and I think I was running this last night, and I was trying to say, okay, over 20 years, over 25 years, like, what does that look like? It comes out to almost $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
That's a lot of money.
$1,000 a month
per person or per couple?
Per couple.
Well, actually, it's less than what I was paying before I got onto Medicare.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
You know, because the healthcare costs in the private world are so expensive if you don't have, you know, your company's insurance.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
You know, I retired at age 58, so I went for 7 years having to provide my own insurance.
Sure.
I was spending $1,500 a year, or a month, rather.
Yeah. But that's so easy to see how it can be even more than that estimate.
Yeah, yeah.
It can really get out of control. And if that number is not pinpointed accurately on the front end of retirement, and I guess it actually, now that I say this, it sort of ties back into the spending and expenses. You need to know what you're spending on average per month for healthcare and for Medicare so that you can properly prepare for the next 30 years of your retirement life what your expenses are going to be. And I find that it's one of those topics that a lot of people they overlook. I think if you're in the zone for retirement right now, even if you're not 65, like if you're 62 retiring a little bit early, you at least want to understand the metrics and how Medicare is going to work.
When Audrey and I started to do our homework and look at Medicare and what the premiums and all the different parts A, B, D, I was surprised to learn that Medicare premiums are based on income.
Yeah, well, and the hard thing too is, so it's based on your modified adjusted gross income. So, but if you're in retirement and you're taking IRA distributions and you have maybe some consulting income, it's not just active income, it's everything that flows through to your modified adjusted gross income. That could also include your Social Security. So it's you know, if you get that number over for a couple that's married filing jointly, it's $170,000. If you're over that threshold, you're going to pay a surcharge. It's an income-related monthly adjustment.
Now, that surcharge goes away once the income that you're earning goes away.
Correct,
it's just a phone call or a visit to the Social Security office to have that happen?
Yeah, it's not that simple, though. Mm. It's actually a two-year look back, and it kind of depends on the scenario. So if you retire, if you are working full-time and you retire and you had a life event change by, you know, like retirement, then yes, it could potentially go away. But if you just take less IRA distributions in that year, I don't believe that the IRS is going to look at that and say, yeah, sure, you qualify. So it's a two-year look back. So you'll have to wait really 2 years until that event, you know, from the time that event occurred. The good thing, though, is for the first time going into 2020, and this is one of the adjustments I wanted to talk about, they're actually making that inflation adjusted. So it for a very, very long time, it was one, for a couple that was filing jointly, it was $170,000. It's now going to $174,000, and it's going to index each year, apparently. Okay.
So, John, you mentioned earlier about understanding what your expenses are and your spending habits. Mm-hmm. How often are your clients aware of exactly what they're spending? And then how do you get them on track, or how do you educate them to say, this is what you really, this is like super important that you know exactly what you spend every year?
So the answer of how often I want them to be versus how often they are probably two different answers. But I would say it's something that we go through at least quarterly. You know, we do an audit of what those are, and we help clients put mechanisms at play so they're not overspending in certain categories. Truly, truly, it should be something that you're intentional about on a monthly basis. I mean, especially in retirement, the expenses, knowing your expenses are more important than ever in retirement, because you're living on a defined income usually.
On our show, I would be safe to say that three of the four shows a month we mention about know how much you spend, mm-hmm. because it's something that we run into when we coach individuals and couples. Yeah. You know, we ask them, okay, tell us about your spending habits, and they look at you like, what do you mean? We pay the rent, the car payment, the credit card.
Yeah.
After that, they have no clue.
Well, the other thing you get is, well, I check my bank account daily.
Yes.
Well,
yeah. That,
yeah. Checking your bank account daily is much different than planning for your expenses and making sure you're spending on what's more important to you.
Or knowing how much you're spending, you know, in every category.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's easy to avoid it because it's painful, isn't it? I mean, it is. People don't like looking at how much they spent on restaurants or how much they spent going out to coffee shops, but that doesn't change the number either.
And poverty's more painful.
Absolutely.
We find an odd kind of joy in doing that, don't we?
Track your pennies.
That's right.
So, John, you started the show with talking about the R word, recession, because I've been hearing that word for, I don't know, the last half dozen years, that it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. That should not stop anybody from really saving and investing, because they have a strategy as a couple or as an individual, and you need somebody that's going to be the guide.
Well, we all have this bias because 2008, for everyone that's listening to this, including us, that's the most recent recession we've all experienced. So we all have this bias that it's going to be as painful and as deep as 2008 was. And that's not necessarily the case. I mean, recessions happen statistically every 7 to 10 years. Even if you're retiring this next year, you're going to statistically go through several more in your retirement life. So it's not something to necessarily be afraid of. It's just something to really be prepared for, though. And so that's why we talk to people who are in the savings mode of their life. Just be really intentional. Find that extra margin to go from 6 to 9%, like we talked about earlier, you know, because taking advantage of that quote unquote recession, whenever it does happen, those are ways that you can do it.
But and the recession, you know, if it, you know, not if it happens, but when it happens, because we're going to be guaranteed it sooner or later, it's going to happen. But that makes that emergency fund, that savings that you've got outside of your normal retirement, just so much more important. Because, you know, I know that there's never been a recession that lasted 24 months. I don't know what the longest one is, probably 14 or 15 months, something like that. Maybe you know, John. But if you've got that cash set aside so that you're not having to sell stocks and mutual funds and stuff that have lost value because of the recession, then it's not going to really hurt you. And that's a good thing. And that's what you hope to accomplish, I think, right?
I think in that scenario that you just described, the hardest part that some people have is not doing anything at the exact present moment. We all want our money working for us always, all the time, 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it's the hardest advice to hear when it's what you just said. Hey, you know what? It's actually okay to have a little bit extra cash right now to be opportunistic for when that recession does occur. For one of two reasons, not just from an investment perspective, but what if something happens to you? to your position, to your job, you know, if, especially if your job is commission-based. You know, I mean, we saw a lot of that in 2008 where salaries were cut in half and people lost their job. And so, again, do I think it's going to be that bad? No, but you want to be prepared.
Well, based on the statistics you were quoting about how often, we're way overdue for one.
We are.
We're way overdue. And, you know, what would be the worst thing that could happen if you were going to retire this year is for the recession to happen this year, right? You know?
Well, not necessarily that, but how your portfolio might respond to a recession.
Yes.
If you're over-aggressive and you didn't mean to be over-aggressive, that's probably the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah, because I retired in 2007.
Wow.
You know,
right.
And then boom, here comes to in the middle of 2007, and boom, here comes 2008. But because of that cash emergency fund that we had, it didn't really affect too much of anything.
That's incredible.
I hate to interrupt this conversation, but John, thank you so much. You've been a great guest, and hopefully individuals have learned something.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me back.
We'll
I appreciate
look forward
it.
To having you on again.
I like it.
And we do plan on having John back very soon to discuss everyone's favorite topic, taxes. In Matthew chapter 22, Jesus says, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." Yes, even in the Bible, taxes were collected. But why are some people today overpaying when they truly don't have to? John Kennedy will explain why and what you should do about it. That topic will be discussed in early February, so be watching out for that one. In fact, if you have any comments or feedback, or maybe there's a topic that you would like to hear us discuss, you can email us at info@compasscatholic.org. That email address again is info@compasscatholic.org. For John and Evelyn Bean, thank you so much for listening. And remember, we have a brand new podcast waiting for you every Wednesday morning. Simply go to compasscatholic.org. On the homepage, just click on the button podcast and look for 2020 Financial Checkup. This is Manage Your Money God's Way. We're from Compass Catholic Ministries.